a world dominated by fear and mass manipulation of the media, who can you trust? Just when you think there is no hope alive, you find out that there is an alternative news source to turn to. Revere Radio Network, keeping the dream of sovereignty and freedom alive for all. Revere Radio Network.
The views and opinions expressed in the following broadcast do not necessarily reflect the views of Revere Radio Network, Rob Revere, or any other host on the network. They are the personal thoughts and feelings of the host given the presentation. We support total free speech here at Revere Radio Network, even when it's ugly. Enjoy.
Hey, you're listening to Revere Radio Network. Stay tuned.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Revere Radio Network, worldwide home of free speech. You're listening to Nowhere to Run with Chris White. I'm happy to be here today with you. Let's go ahead and start the show, as we do every show here, with our corrections from the previous one. So let's get that going and get started with the program.
I've just picked up a fault in the AE-35 unit.
It wasn't lies, it was just bullshit.
This sort of thing has cropped up before. And it has always been due to human error.
I wiped a booger on your shirt. I made a dog and a cat kiss. I swiped a bolted-down TV from a Holiday Inn. I coveted the wife in Jaws 2. I lied to a waiter. I masturbated 8 billion times. And I have no plans to stop masturbating in the future.
Woohoo! I'm clean! In your face, Lord!
Okay, the first correction, it has to do with Prescott Bush, who is our president's grandfather. And I was talking about his connections to the Nazis and the Nazi Party and whatnot, and I said that he had, quote, super crazy connections with them. And while that is true on one sense, they were super crazy, I thought I would just go ahead and explain a little bit of what exactly super crazy I meant. This is an article from the New Hampshire Gazette, November 7th, 2003, something like that. It's just basically, you can look at the specific details of all the financial dealings, but here's what this article says. After the seizures in late 1942 of five U.S. enterprises he managed, Prescott Bush, on behalf of the Nazi industrialist Fritz Thyssen, Prescott Bush, the grandfather of President George W. Bush, failed to divest himself of more than a dozen, quote, enemy national relationships that continued until as late as 1951, newly discovered U.S. government documents reveal. Furthermore, the records show that Bush and his colleagues routinely attempted to conceal their activities from government investigators. Bush partners in the secret web of Thyssen-controlled ventures included former New York Governor W. Avriel Harriman and his younger brother E. Roland Harriman. The quarter century of Nazi financial transactions from 1924 to 1951 were conducted by the New York private banking firm Brown Brothers Harriman. Now, there's a lot of details about what actually financial dealings were gone. I encourage you to look into it. It's really crazy, and it has a lot to do with the formation of this country. I think it was the person who wrote this article summed up part of this about my concerns of it. Let's see here. However, others see an even larger significance. The discovery of The Bush Nazi documents raises new questions about the role of Prescott Bush and his influential business partners in the secret immigration of Nazi war criminals, which allowed them to escape justice in Germany, says Bob Furtick, co-founder of Democrats.com and an amateur, quote, Nazi hunter. It also raises questions about the importance of Nazi recruits to the CIA in the early years. It was called Operation Paperclip, and Prescott Bush's role in that dark operation. Furtick and others, including former Justice Department Nazi war crimes prosecutor John Loftus, a constitutional attorney in Miami, and former Veterans Administration official, believe Prescott Bush and Harrimans should have been tried for treason. Well, when you look at what they all did and how they covered up these financial dealings with the Nazis, and I mean, you can't say that bringing the Nazis over and the connection to the CIA isn't just a little bit coincidence that his son was head of the CIA who distributed these paperclip people. And that's Nazis, you know, from Germany. That's crazy. That were, you know, mind control scientists and rocket scientists, which later turned out to be our NASA operation, or a majority of the information there. Okay, that was a long correction. This next correction is very interesting. I just started looking into it just to confirm something I said in the other show, and it just opened up door after door after door, and I don't think many people are looking into this guy, and I think his information about his life and the things he did holds a lot of the keys to a lot of these different conspiracies. I think he is the center of a lot of this, and you follow this guy around, you're going to find a lot of information about a lot of different things. Louis Jolyon West. This is the name of the psychiatrist, Louis Jolyon West. Now, my correction is that I said that he was a psychiatrist for Lee Harvey Oswald and Sirhan Sirhan and Tim McVeigh. Where I was wrong is he wasn't the psychiatrist for Oswald. He was the guy who came in during Jack Ruby's trial who shot Oswald. During Jack Ruby's detention, this Jolyon West came in and was the psychiatrist who pronounced Jack Ruby to be insane and delusional when he started talking about conspiracies to kill the president. And he also put Jack Ruby on, quote, happy pills, which, if you follow this guy's career, is a huge proponent, even on his dying day, was saying that everybody needs to be drugged by drugs. It's the only way to perfection. But that's a weird connection. He kind of did the same thing with a lot of different people. He did that in Sirhan Sirhan's trial, and he did in a very similar thing with Patty Hearst at her trial. He also did that with Timothy McVeigh. Here's a weird connection with this guy. During the trial of Tim McVeigh, of the Oklahoma City bombing guy, he was reported by none other than Chandra Levy, who, if you remember, right before September 11th, was that, you know, the girl who got killed, I believe, by, you know, and it was suspicion about the whatever, that she was an intern at the Bureau of Prisons, who, and she was making notes that Jolyon West had made, like, you know, some odd 13 visits to Tim McVeigh, and, you know, there's lots of weird connections about that. Anytime that it seems like Louis Jolyon West, who even in the public domain is known to be a brainwashing expert, that's his forte, with an expertise in electroshock and drugs, but a brainwashing expert nonetheless. Go to look at his Wikipedia. It doesn't say too many nefarious things about him, but it definitely does say that and you can read between the lines a little bit there, but I encourage you to look into this guy's history, because he is everywhere a mind-controlled assassin is. And cults, too. He was a really big on cults, which is, if you know anything about this mind control, which I've been learning a lot lately, it all ties into these network of cults and the covering up, because it's a ritual murders a lot of times. And this guy just happens to sit on the board of, like, how to determine, you know, if something's a cult. He's the go-to man anytime there is any kind of question about mind control or quotes or cults or anything like that. You go to this guy. But he has connections with people you just wouldn't believe. He pioneered a lot of stuff. He also has a really interesting story about killing an elephant with LSD and playing around and it's shit. And while he was himself was on LSD at a zoo in front of some kids, And I guess, yeah, so that's a really weird story. You should really look into that. As a matter of fact, I will post some links to some articles on this Jolyon West that I've found on the Revere Radio website at the on the forums. If you go to the forums, I'll put it under I think paranormal. That section is something about mind control. So I'll post that here pretty soon, and you can look at that. And I do think that that nobody's looking into this, and I feel like, you know, this is a really big deal. In fact, I think of all the things that I've been looking into, this is probably the most touchy, and I feel like the one that somebody wouldn't want anything coming out about. Just for the record, you know, just because I have a radio show and I can do this, I want to say that, you know, I am very not suicidal, and I am a really good driver, and if I ever make any dramatic changes in my mood or different statements that's not consistent with the other stuff that I have in the show, or I'm dead, or, you know, anything like that, that is, you can know who to blame, and it will be evident of the people to blame by the things that I talk about on this radio show. So just if ever anything like that happens, and go kick some ass for me, and take some names too while you're at it. And you'll know that all the stuff that I've been saying, or something that I've been saying, is true enough to get killed for. So that will validate some of that. If that ever happens, then you'll know. Okay, I feel better about doing that. And I think that's my corrections for the day, too.
Now, it's important to understand where the increase began so that you can understand the importance of long-term blah, blah, blah,
look
blah,
at
blah,
these
blah.
Smiling
blah,
faces.
Blah, 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 blah,
they just
blah,
don't
blah,
have a clue.
Blah, blah,
look at
blah,
them.
Blah, blah, blah,
don't they know that I don't know what I'm talking about? How long is it before I'm finally found out?
Blah, blah, blah,
when is someone going to expose me for the fraud that I am?
Blah, blah, blah.
And now for something completely different.
All right, in this show, I have, I think I'm going to go through, I got a lot of great information on my MP3 player, a lot of sound clips, and I think I'm just going to go through them and play just a grab bag of different information bits and have a little commentary on them, but mostly just kind of going through them because there's so much in so many varied areas. So I'm going to do that. Let's go ahead and take a short break. I'll just do some short stuff here, and we'll get right into it. So stay tuned. Thanks for listening to the Revere Radio Network, and this is Nowhere to Run. I'll be right back.
This is a public service announcement.
Bayline.com is your number one site on the internet to keep you informed and up to date in this information war. With us losing more and more civil liberties each and every day, Bayline.com is a great tool to have so you can stay informed and learn how you can help topple big government. Simply go to www.phaylon.com. www.phaylon.com. You get 24/7 access to all media, your very own live stream free with your subscription, 300 plus educational videos, fast forward and rewind, pause to watch later, live news channels, all available when you subscribe to phaylon.com for just 19 cents a day. That's 19 cents a day. phaylon.com. You hate big government, so do we. phaylon.com.
Coming at you with music and fun. And if you're not careful, you may learn something before it's done.
Okay, let's get right into this. Like I said, I got a lot of audio clips for you today. Different from different areas and stuff. The first one I'm going to play, I think, is from Chuck Missler, M-I-S-S-L-E-R. This is from his series, The Return of the Nephilim. this guy is great. I only discovered him about a month ago, and I cannot believe it. I mean, he is like saying everything that I've been wanting to say, but didn't even know it, and couldn't do it that well. This guy is a big role model for me. I'm so glad I found him. He's also contemporary of and a friend of Hal Lindsey, who I have known about for many, many, many years. And so I am really happy to find this guy. He's just such a genius. Anyway, this clip is about 22 minutes long. I'll probably play the whole thing because it's just really interesting. But go ahead and do that and enjoy.
I want to call your attention to a verse. Again, this is one of those things, unless you're looking carefully, you may miss. When we get down to verse 9 of Genesis 6, there's a comment on Noah and his family tree. It says, these are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations. These are the generations of Noah, and Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations. Now, the word perfect is tamim, which means without blemish, sound healthful, without spot, unimpaired. That's an adjective that is describing his family tree. The word generations is all through the scripture. It precedes all the genealogies that you read about. Noah had an unblemished genealogy. It's speaking of his pedigree. The inference that you can draw as a student of the word here is that Noah might have been the only one, but in any case, was uncontaminated by the strategies of these fallen angels. The word tamim, by the way, is without blemish, is used of physical blemishes, not of moral blemishes. I could give you several dozen places to take a concordance, take a look at the word. It appears in the Old Testament. It speaks of offerings, of not being a blemish. It's a physical blemish that's without spot, undefiled in a sense. The lexicons point out that it does not speak of his moral perfection, but it tells us that his family, perhaps alone, preserved the pedigree and kept it pure in spite of the prevailing corruption brought on by these angels. Now, I say, gee, that's pretty weird stuff. If that's correct, if our view of this is correct, it should show up in the New Testament. So you might turn with me, if you will, to the book of Jude. Go to the book of Revelation and turn left one book. The little book of Jude, one of the most fascinating books in the Bible, written by the Lord's brother, I believe. And it's a little brief book. Our commentary, I think, we went through 8 tapes on this short little book. There's so much here that just tucked away in this fascinating book of Jude. But one chapter, a couple dozen verses. But let's look at verse 6. It says in your English Bible, Jude is making a point, by the way. He's talking about false teachers and the destiny they have. And he's talking about how people in the past have been punished, therefore false teachers of the future will be punished. He's making an argument in that direction. But he makes an allusion here that catches our attention. In verse 6, he says, and the angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he hath reserved in everlasting change under darkness unto the judgment of the great day. Now, this left their own habitation. The word in the Greek there is ideon, which means their own private, personal, unique possession is what they left. They left it, and the word apolipo is in the aorist tense, which means they left it once and for all. There was no going back. We're going to find, if you go to the next verse, it says, Jude continues, even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities about them in like manner, giving themselves over to fornication and going after strange flesh. The word strange there is heteros. There's two. If you want something, you want another something, in the Greek there's two words, allos and heteros. If I have a pencil and I would like you to get me a pencil exactly like this when I use the word allos. If I want a pen rather than a pencil or something, I want something different than a pencil. I use it in English, I say another, but in the Greek I would say heteros. Heteros means something of a totally different kind. And that's what's used here. They're going after strange flesh. Now also what many people miss is that Jude, in his structure here, is tying together the sin of the angels with the sins of Sodom and Gomorrah. Both of them were of sexual aberrations. But he's talking about these angels, which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation. What's happened to them? He hath reserved an everlasting chains unto darkness unto the judgment of that great day. These angels that did all this are presently, as we speak, tucked away for a future judgment. They are sealed off in a strange place. Not in the usual concept of Hades. We'll come back to that. Peter gives us a little glimpse here. We'll come to that in a minute. But these, the New Testament, thus, Jude is alluding here to the same thing that we've been talking about. Now, if we go to 2 Peter chapter 2, turn to the left a few books and get to 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter also is taking up the same kind of an argument and on the same sort of subject that Jude does about these false teachers. And he's warning the false teachers. But again, he's using the same kind of expression that Jude did. He's making an allusion, if these guys got theirs, what about you, kind of thing. In chapter 2, verse 4, Peter says, "For if God spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down to Tartarus," it's translated hell in your English Bible. The word Tartarus in the Greek is the only place it occurs in the New Testament. I'll come back to the word. "And delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved in judgment, and spared not the old world that saved Noah," and he goes on. So Peter tells us when this took place. You see, it took place at the time of the flood of Noah. So these fallen angels fornicating with women and having these bizarre offspring occurred when? Before the flood. So it all ties together. Genesis 6 ties together with 2 Peter 2, verse 4, and Jude, verses 6 and 7. Are we together so far? Okay. Now, the word Tartarus, by the way, only appears here in 2 Peter 2, 4 in the New Testament, but it is used in Greek classical literature. In Homer's Odyssey, I believe it is. It speaks of a place that is so, it is as far below Hades as Hades is below the earth. So the term Tartarus in the Greek language is a vocabulary confined to the place that these fallen angels are sequestered until the final judgment. Spooky stuff. I'd like us to be, as we go forward here, to make a distinction, though. Many people who write books on this subject confuse the angels that sinned with their offspring. The angels that sin are angels. Okay? Now, let's start with that. The first problem we have, as many of you may recall, that Jesus makes a remark that many people misunderstand. In Matthew chapter 22, verse 30, and Mark 12, 25, Jesus indicates that angels in heaven don't marry. And people quote that verse to prove, well, this has to be all wrong because angels can't have sex. Doesn't say they can't, they don't. And we're talking about the angels in heaven, not the fallen angels. And the comments that Jesus made are, first of all, subsequent to this. I think the angels may have learned their lesson. But also, it doesn't limit their capabilities to commit felonies of the fallen ones. It's kind of interesting to notice, by the way, let's poke into 2 Peter chapter 3. In verse 3 following, a well-quoted verse, but I'd like to highlight some things in here. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 3, "Knowing this first, that there shall come in the last days scoffers walking after their own lusts and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. For this they are willingly ignorant of, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, by which the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. But the heavens and the earth, which are now by the same word, are kept in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and the perdition of ungodly men." What many people miss in this passage is not just pointing out that at the end times, scoffers will disparage the idea of the second coming of Christ. We often quote verse 3 in that context. It's certainly true. It's interesting when you run into people that, and many in churches, that sort of disdain your interest in the second coming Remember, that was one of the signs of the times, is that this verse, that there shall come in the last days scoffers walking after the lust. But notice what they're saying. That where is the promise of his coming? For all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. Which is not true, but that's what they believe. There are some gigantic discontinuities in the history of planet Earth. And the biggest one occurred in Genesis 3. What we know about the creation, we know about it post-curse. Everything we know about the universe is after the fall of Adam. I usually challenge people, prove to me that Adam lived in only three dimensions. I'm not trying to make a point other than to realize that we know very little about what it was like prior to sin, prior when he walked with God, etc. Genesis 3 was a gigantic discontinuity. Some scientists believe that's when the speed of light first starts slowing down. That's when entropy was introduced, according to Romans 8. All kinds of issues there. The other big discontinuity occurred in Genesis 6. The flood of Noah was not just a lot of water. Scientists have studied pterodactyls and believe they could not fly unless the atmospheric pressure was twice what it is today. We know that the ecology of the Earth is quite different. We find the tropical plants enshrined in ice in Siberia. There's all kinds of evidence that the Earth had a totally different climate, totally different system way, way back. So a lot changed at the flood, far more than we probably have any real insight into. And so something very drastic is going on. Now, I'd like to touch on a couple of other things here. Let's talk about angels. Let's not confuse ourselves about angels. We're talking here about some misbehaving angels, but let's understand what angels are. All through the scripture, we find occasions where angels are mistaken for men. Mistaken for men. They eat. They ate with Abraham and Sarah in Genesis 18. They fought with the homosexuals in Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis 19. One angel after dinner in 2 Kings chapter 19 wipes out 185,000 Assyrian army. You don't mess around with angels. They're rough dudes. Hebrews 13 tells us that many of us may have entertained angels unawares. What does that tell us? It tells us that they're capable of being mistaken, at least, for men. They look, feel, act tangibly when they want to. I'm not suggesting you're limited to that, but they certainly have that capability. So this idea that angels don't marry is an attribution that Jesus makes of angels in heaven that are properly behaved. Okay? Now, the union in Genesis 6 was not natural, and they had very bizarre offspring. And the reason for that offspring was a plot of Satan that we will deal with in our subsequent session. This is part one of a two-part session. And we'll get into I want to make a point, though. Don't confuse the B'nai HaElohim, the angels, with their offspring, the Nephilim. Many authors that write on this, otherwise quite competently, you quickly discover they mix those two subjects up. The Nephilim, technically, are the offspring, the giants on the earth. Now, we're going to discover that those giants did not end with the flood of Noah. We'll discover the giants are all through the Old Testament. We'll discover that it was a strategy of Satan. One of his strategies to thwart the plan of God was to corrupt the human race so that it would not qualify for a kinsman redeemer, the messianic line. We'll discover that if God revealed his plan of redemption, that it would come through Abraham, and then Isaac, then Jacob, and then through Judah, the royal line. As God focuses his prophecies, it allows Satan to focus his attack. So whether you're talking about the angels of the Nephilim of Genesis 6, or whether you're talking about the slaughter of the babes in the days of Pharaoh, or whether you're talking about the slaughter of the babes at Bethlehem, or on and on and on all the way through. We'll go through that next time, some of those things, because it's very limited. You discover that Satan's attack is an attempt to thwart the plan of God. And you'll discover that part of that attack was to anticipate Abraham's deliverance to Canaan by populating Canaan with some of these creatures. Because they get there before Abraham, and that's the problem in the conquest of Joshua and the rest. You wonder, gee, I read the Old Testament, and there's these bizarre instructions. Wipe out every man, woman, and child of these tribes. You've got to be kidding. I mean, that's heartless. Why? There's a reason. It has to do with the gene pool. It has to do with what God is instructing them to do. So we'll talk about that next time. Now, I'm going to suggest that I believe what we're experiencing here on the planet Earth is the return of Satan's emissaries. Why? We'll discover throughout the prophetic literature, once you realize that some of these words can be translated several ways, and you take your computer or your concordance and do a search in the Old and New Testament on the Nephilim, the Anakim, the Rephaim, and so forth, you discover all kinds of things. Now, one of the problems that I've had in my biblical studies for 40 years is there's a tendency of all of us as we read the literature to assume that the demons are fallen angels. I've always been bothered by that because they're antithetical. The angels are capable of materializing. We see that all through the place. The demons can't. They seek embodiment. And I've always bothered by that. No one hits it head on. Well, it's very interesting because in Isaiah 26, we'll discover, as we get into it next time, only man is capable of redemption. See, Christ didn't become an angel. He became a man to pay the price of our eligibility for an eternity with him. Well, I got interesting thing comes up here. You've got the flood of Noah. You've got these fallen angels that come into the daughters of men and they have offspring, the Nephilim. What happened to the angels? Very big trouble. They're in Tartarus. Okay. The Nephilim, what happened to them? They're wiped out in the flood, right? They are dead. The bodies are. But they're half man, half spirit, right? What happened to their spirits? They're disembodied. There's a view. It's a tenuous one, but it's one that I tend to lean toward. I believe the demons are the spirits of the Nephilim that were wiped out in the flood. And they're still Satan's hosts. They're seeking embodiment. Apparently desperately. In the New Testament, we find in one case at least, a couple of thousand of them pleaded to be allowed to enter the swan. We all studied the case of the deviled ham back there in Mark. I know. Well, what we're going to do next time, we're going to get at, we've been through the light stuff, we're getting to the heavy stuff next time. The whole story that you and I are beneficiaries of starts in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. Any one of you that have had a serious Bible study have trafficked heavily, I'm sure, in Genesis chapter 3 in general and verse 15 in particular. And this is famous because it's the first declaration of the forthcoming Messiah. When Adam and Eve fall, God declares war on Satan, on the Nachash, the Shining One. And in verse 15, speaking to Satan, he says, I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed, and he shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. And from this passage emerges a title of the Messiah, the Mashiach, the seed of the woman. And anyone that's done a serious prophetic study around Christmas time has been into this, the idea of the seed, in the grammar as well as in the biology, it's a contradiction. Because the seed is the man, not the woman. Idiomatically, and of course biologically. But here we have what in effect is a contradiction, the seed of the woman. It's a phrase that if you've done your homework, it has to strike you strange. If you're a rabbi studying this very precisely, it puzzles you. Of course, it's clarified in Isaiah 7:14, where a virgin shall conceive and bear a son. And we know the whole story of Jesus Christ as being born of a virgin. The seed of the woman is here hinted at in Genesis 3, and it's a tremendous study that if you haven't done, you need a high priority item to really familiarize yourself with the thread of promises. We start here and climax at a cross. In fact, actually goes beyond the cross. We climax in the book of Revelation. What everybody ignores is verse 15 speaks of two seeds. The seed of the woman, and what other seed? Seed of the serpent. Now, many people view that as just meaning those that follow Satan, those that worship Satan, and so forth. And I'm not saying it doesn't include that. But the term here, the seed of the woman, speaks of a specific person with a specific mission and a specific destiny on a cross in Judea several thousand years ago. I believe the other seed also is a specific person who has a specific destiny here on the planet Earth. Hal Lindsey and Dave Hunt and other conservative biblical speakers that I've shared platforms with have stated publicly, they have the suspicion, at least, that when the Antichrist shows up, he either will boast of an alien connection of some kind or be one. And there's a number of hints in the scripture to back that up. We'll explore some of those ideas next time. But let's tie it off for tonight. What are we really talking about? What is the agenda of these strange goings-on, whether it's crop circles or the UFOs or these so forth? Well, when Jesus was first approached by four disciples for a confidential briefing on his second coming, we have it recorded in Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, the chapters following. And when he talks to these four disciples in the confidential briefing, the first thing he says, let no man deceive you. If you read Matthew 24, or whether you read Paul's advice to Timothy in chapter 4, verse 1, all through the scripture we are warned that in the end times, the primary warfare will be one of deception. And I think most of you that have been following our materials here recognize that I perceive, personally, that you and I are being plunged into an age that I call the age of deceit.
Okay, that was Chuck Missler. From his series, Return of the Nephilim. He's got a lot of MP3 files on the net. You can subscribe to khouse.org, and they have just a huge resource of his stuff. He's a genius, and he hits every single possible issue. It's really good stuff. Yeah, he was talking about the age of deceit. That is right. We're going into that. I was just thinking about, you know, with this Project Paperclip and America bringing over all these mind control scientists from Nazi Germany and also the rocket engineering scientists from Germany after the war, which created our NASA program. And I was reading something about the NASA space weapons program and all this stuff that they have as far as research and, you know, these new technologies they're working on at NASA nowadays that are probably so far advanced, you know, depending on what their actual agenda is for these technologies that NASA is developing, you know, what could they convince us of by letting some kind of technology, you know, I'm reminded of the Bible verse, you know, like in fire in full view of men, you know, that changes people in this deception, you know, I mean, there's no telling what kind of technology that can also deceive us or be part of the deception, the coming deception, which I think they're going to roll out with this new religion. Something about the 2012 thing, I'm not 100% sure how this is all going to work yet. I don't claim that I'll ever know, but, you know, maybe we will all know real soon. I don't know. I'm going to play another real quick break, and we're going to get right back into some more audio clips from different subjects and different people. And this next one coming up is going to be Michael Parenti about the media. It's really good. This guy is very charismatic and a good speaker and has really good information. So I'm going to take this quick break, and we'll be right back.
One of the interesting things about the media personnel is the revolving door. They go from government to corporations, back to the media, to government. Leslie Gelb was in corporate America, then he was in State Department, then he was the Washington Post, then he's Then he's back in government. Diane Sawyer, she was with the Nixon administration, and now she's a media personality. She went off with Pat and Dick to California when he retired to help him write his memoirs, and now we see her on ABC. Pat Buchanan. Pat Buchanan was a columnist, a far right-wing columnist, then he went in and became a speechwriter for the Nixon administration. Then he was out again as a commentator, a journalist. And then he was in with the Reagan administration. And now he's out and he's a journalist again. So he's been either a journalist or a White House flack for his whole life. In other words, in his whole life, he's never had an honest job. You know? Pete Williams. I remember Pete Williams. He was in that film I mentioned to you, Panama Deception, which I'm partial to because I'm in it too. I was being interviewed in that film. And Pete Williams kept coming on. Pentagon spokesman. Now, this is an objective journalist, right? The Pentagon spokesman would say, look, El Chiria neighborhoods in Panama have been bombed by U.S. planes. 3,000 people killed. He says, I have no evidence of that. We'd run, cut in and run footage, and you see these houses burning and all that, and the bodies lying there. I know of no such atrocity. Pete Williams leaves the Pentagon, and he is now national correspondent for NBC. Now, if you had some other country where this was happening, where people were working 1 year for Pravda, the next year for the KGB, next year in the foreign ministry, the next year for Pravda again, well, you'd say, boy, they don't have an independent press. Boy, that's really totalitarian, isn't it? Right. Now, reporters fall into two kinds. When I wrote my book, Inventing Reality, I talked to reporters and interviewed some of them. There are those who will say to you, oh, yes, you have to have very finely attuned antenna as to just how far you could go, and if you go any further, they'll zap you. And then there are others, and usually those were ex-reporters. Those are ones who used to be with Associated Press, or used to do this, used to that, and they're no longer doing that. The other ones are the other 97% of the reporters I run into, and journalists and editors and such, they're the ones who get very indignant that you suggest that they are influenced by anything other than their own discerning, independent insight, you see. So are you telling me that I'm not my own man? I'll have you know that in 20 years with this newspaper, I always said what I like. And I answered, you say what you like because they like what you say. And you have no sensation of being repressed because your views are perfectly coterminous with those of your boss. Your unexamined assumptions, your use of terms like reform and swamp rat and whatever else are exactly the kind of stuff they want to hear. It fits. Your ideological perspective is theirs. So you don't have any sensation of restraint. You know, if you have a leash around your neck, but you spend your whole life sitting by the peg, you don't feel restrained. It's only when you try to stray to a forbidden parameter that suddenly you feel the tug. As I felt, why, right on this very campus 25 years ago. Nicholas Johnson gives the case of the four stages of the socialization of a journalist. In stage one, the young, dedicated, idealistic reporter goes out and he investigates something and he writes this expose about local power guys who also happen to be big advertisers for the newspaper. And he comes back and he shows it to his editor and the editor says, no, that's silly, we can't do that. No, that won't fly. Stage two, he doesn't go out and write it. He gets another idea about something that should be looked into, but he goes talk to the editor first and the editor says, no, forget it, forget that. Stage three, he gets the idea and then he dismisses it himself and says, nah, that's silly. And in stage four, he no longer gets the idea, no longer critically looks at that. And I added stage five. Stage five, he gets on panels with media critics like me and gets very indignant if I suggest that there are influences on him and all that. Well, if it's true that the news is so conservative and so serves the powers that be, why do conservatives keep attacking it as a liberal media? Why not? Keeps it on its toes, keeps it leaning to the right, dressing to the right, keeps it from going too far over to this side. Why not? Of course. And furthermore, for conservatives, for a far-right group, there are things that they don't want to see that are in the regular media. See, if the right-wing ideologues had their way completely, they would want the average newspaper to just be story after celebration of the free market, the wonders and glories of free market capitalism, a few anti-communist horror stories, lots of crime in there, and then some cooking recipes, crossword puzzle, comics, and all that. Which, by the way, describes a lot of newspapers in America. We used to have one here that attacked me every other day. Burlington Free Press. Is it still around, the Burlington Free Press? We used to call it the Burlington Repress. They had a really terrible right-wing editor in those days named Frank Smith. He was the last editor in America to keep defending Richard Nixon before Nixon left the White House in disgrace for the Watergate thing. The New York Times would run his op-eds because they couldn't find anyone else willing to defend Nixon. That was Frank Smith. There's another problem conservatives do face. To some extent, the media does have to sometimes report hard news. Yeah, even their own ruling elites want to know some things that are going on. And when they report hard news, that gets them sort of close to the real world. And when they get close to the real world, you find that the real world is radical. The real world is leftist. It's not that we leftists make up these things. I don't mean that people out in the real world are radical or leftist. I mean the events that we talk about are real. It's not a leftist ideological argument that people are getting downsized and downgraded. It's the real world that's actually happening. It's not a leftist ideological propaganda view that the CEOs and the top 1% of the population are now enjoying a concentration of wealth that's 100% higher than it was 20 years ago. That happens to be an objective fact. We didn't make that up. We only discover it. It's the leftists who want to propagate it and want to publicize it a lot more. It's not a leftist ideological propaganda theme that children in Indonesia, in Guatemala, in El Salvador, in Haiti are working every day for 10, 12 cents an hour, 12 hours a day, that 300, 400 million children in the world are working, children in India, in the sex industry, in carpet industry, going blind, going lame, going every other thing without any kind of protections. That's not something we made up. That's something that the right will suppress because it reflects poorly on capital, and that's something that's real and it's out there. And to the extent that the media ever takes notice of a toxic waste dump or something like that, or waste in the Pentagon or something like that, that's when the conservatives say, you see, it's a liberal conspiracy to make corporate America look bad. That's terrible. You shouldn't be talking about those things. And you must talk about them probably because you're a leftist or a liberal. No, they mention it every so often because that's reality. Reality is radical. Well, I think I'm going to wrap it up there. Let me just add that one last question that inevitably comes up. So tell me, Parenti, what do you have, a conspiracy theory? I mean, do you feel there's this small group of people who are plotting this whole thing? I mean, don't you think the force of circumstances, institution, market necessity, that makes things happen? And do you think they actually plan? Do you think there's a small group of men sitting around in a room plotting all this stuff? Somehow that image is supposed to be the most devastating one. That's the one where you're supposed to shrink back and say, oh. They, no. They don't sit around in a room. They meet on carousels and they go up and down on horses and talk. Or they jump out of airplanes, and as they're free falling, they talk about the, what about a merger? What about? Of course they meet in rooms. Where the hell else do you think they meet? Of course they meet in rooms. They got lots of rooms. There are rooms in the White House. There are rooms at General Motors. There are rooms at the Bohemian Grove where they go. There are rooms at the Council for Foreign Relations. There are rooms at the Trilateral Commission meetings. There are rooms at the Bilderberg Conference. I looked at the roster list, 1989. I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist. I was looking at 1988 or so, the Bilderberg Conference. Now, this is an international conference of all the elites of various countries, the financial and political elites. Isn't that interesting how economics and politics, the leaders, always seem to get together? There's no conspiracy. No. But they just happen to go to the same spas and places. And so, of course, I immediately turn to the U.S. page, and I see the first name on the U.S. delegation list is a representative from Rockefeller Brothers Association, David Rockefeller. And the next name on the list puzzled me. I'd never seen it before. It was Honorable Bill Clinton, governor of Arkansas. And I said, what the hell is the governor of Arkansas doing at the Bilderberg Conference? Who is this guy? I didn't know much about Clinton. I knew he had used the National Guard and sent him down to Honduras and all that. Well, you know what happened less than a year and a half later? Why, suddenly the corporate media was saying front runner for the Democratic nomination, Bill Clinton. Interesting. Just a little morsel I want you to be intrigued by. Yes, they do consciously conspire to advance their own interests. You do. School teachers organize and try to get a better deal and try to understand what the policies are, what their options are, what their possibilities are. Farmers organize and do that. The minute you suggest that the ruling elites, the guys who own most of the capital, most of the land, practically all the technology, and control almost all the labor in this country, the minute you suggest that they might be concerned about their interests and try to advantage themselves and propagate it, someone says, well, you got a conspiracy theory? You consciously pursue your self-interests. You wonder about what courses I should take, what should I do this summer, where should I live, can I get that job, this, that, the other thing. What makes you think they don't consciously, willfully pursue their interests and pursue the operational power that is needed to ensure and advance their interests as ruthlessly as they have to. Not directly. They hire people to do the dirty work for them. Well, what is to be done? You know, there's an awful lot to do. You as an individual maybe can do very little, but you can join with others. You can join and work with Spark to help advance and educate and agitate. You can support alternative media. There are a few small radio stations that carry alternative perspectives. There's about 78 of the 9,000 radio stations in America. There's about 78 that are willing to carry my talks now. Support alternative publications like the Monthly Review, Covert Action Quarterly, People's Weekly World, Multinational Monitor. Various public interest groups have their own newspapers or newsletters. Peace groups have both important vital information. There's a local alternative newspaper right out here in the back. I'm sorry, Robin, the name escapes me, but it's
Toward Freedom.
Okay, Toward Freedom. And that's right out there, and you can start educating yourself. You can challenge the mainstream media with letters to the editor, calls to the editors and publishers, call in to radio talk shows. I do that. It's getting harder and harder. In the last maybe 15, 20 years, I've had about 5 letters in the Washington Post and about 4 in the New York Times and 2 op-eds in the New York Times, 1 op-ed in the LA Times, and rather limited issues or questions too, but something. And now it's gotten, in the last 5 years, it's harder and harder. But you can still call up and you can still write. And even if they don't run it, they often get worried when they get too much info. When you see something really egregious and deceptive in that way, and above all, we can organize, agitate, educate, and create alternative political movements. George Bush called that class war, when we start to criticize the rich and powerful who abuse us and human labor and the environment. He calls that class war. See, whenever we fight back, whenever ordinary people fight back, we're called waging class war. They're doing class war all the time on our heads. The minute we fight back against it, they go, oh, that's class war. You're being divisive, and you mustn't do that. Yeah, divisive. Just like rebellious slaves were being divisive. That they were being divisive. They were disrupting the beauty and harmony of the magnolia piece of the plantation. And that's us, folks. You can call that class war, this fighting back, this agitating. But I have another word for it also. It is class war, but it's something else. When people act as the active social agents of their own lives, I have another word for that. That's called democracy. Uh-huh. Democracy, democracy, and let's have more of it. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
TV rots your brain like it's crack cocaine.
Who is on first base? What is on second? And I don't know who's on third base.
Who's on first?
Yes.
Who?
Yes. Who is the man on first base?
Why are you asking me? I'm asking you. What's the name of the guy in first base?
No. What is on... Oh, I see what your problem is.
Revere Radio Network Tampa, the worldwide home of free speech.
Okay, kind of a clip show today, just a different format, partially due to the fact that I've been extremely busy this week with the band and also with putting together some information about fluoride. I'm going to make a presentation to my city here in Tennessee for the removal of fluoride from our water supplies. And I'm kind of at the beginning stages of that, and I'm going to mass produce this system so other people can do it too, if successful, or even if it's not successful. But the system should be very sound, and I'm really excited about the project. If you want to support that or anything that we do here at the show, you can go to conspiracyclothes.com or conspiratees.org, and you can get a shirt. It's my company, conspiracyclothes.com. We have shirts on September 11th, fluoride, the Bill of Rights, the Pyramid, and the Federal Reserve, with more on the way. And it's kind of a good way to support any of this. I don't really, you know, this isn't for profit, and I would never take any money for this radio show or anything like that. But some of this stuff just requires so damn much money. But first, Revere Radio is the one that, if you do have a little extra money, would be a good place to put it. and donate some money there. Also, some of the advertisers on Revere, I know Phalon.com does a lot of work, and they are a really good resource for information, for video, audio, lots of different media, and it's a great way to get a lot of the different media. They do great work there. So yeah, check out all the advertisers on Revere, and if you yourself have anything that you would want to advertise, the rates for the recorded spots that run on Revere are extremely cheap. So if you know anybody that has something that they would like to advertise, suggest it, because it is a very effective means of advertising, and the price can't be beat. You can't get that kind of exposure for that kind of money anywhere, period. So it's a very good thing. I am probably going to get out of here, but I would remind you to check out the forums in Revere too, where I posted on the paranormal section some of the information about that Dr. Jolien West. I'd like to reiterate how important I think this is. It's a big deal. I haven't been meaning to do so much stuff on mind control and Project Paperclip and Project, you know, Monarch and MK Ultra and all that stuff, Bluebird and what's some others, you know, all that stuff, but it's just kind of come up lately, and I've been just, all this stuff keeps presenting itself to me almost, so that's why been doing a lot of shows on it lately. But I encourage everybody to look into it for themselves. There's a lot of information out there, and I will talk to everybody next week. I'm going to play some music on the way out, and everybody take it easy. Long live Revere.